Hey, for lab this afternoon, most of you are aware that faculty have the third test, okay? So if you just want to meet here at 1:30 and take as much time as you need, it shouldn't be any longer than the other ones, very similar format. And then after that, I thought what we might do is, I know you guys get done taking the test, you don't feel like doing a whole lot, and I can understand that. So what I'll do is have down in the lab some examples of projects that have been turned in the past, and you guys can look through them. And these don't have grades on them, so I'm not, the fact that I've got them out for you to look at doesn't necessarily mean it's a good one or a bad one. I'll leave that up to you to decide. And I think there's some of each, but you can draw your own conclusions. But I think what it will do is give you some ideas on maybe how to put this stuff together. And I think it's supposed to be a little showery this afternoon, but if you want, I'd encourage you to even go out and maybe start working on your project if you can. And I will try and give you a little more time during the semester, the rest of the semester, to go out and do this. But I'll also have some textures down there that you can practice on. So that's pretty much it. I'll keep it light after the test. Now, I know some of you have started studying and have come up with questions, and I mentioned on Tuesday that I'd be willing to devote a little time beginning a class to maybe go over the old exam or any questions that you guys have about it. So with that, I'll gladly entertain any questions that you have, unless they're from Hannah. No, just kidding. So no questions?
Go, Hannah.
Okay. I have a question on the true or false one. All BK horizons are calcic horizons. That's not true necessarily, right? Because you were talking about the horizon designations.
Oh, number four.
Yeah.
Yeah, what do you guys think? True or false?
False.
Okay, I would agree with you. Anybody think it's true? How about if it said many BK horizons are calcic horizons?
True.
Yeah, that one probably would work, but not, certainly not all. Are all calcic horizons BK horizons? Probably. I can't think of too many cases where that wouldn't be the case. I can't think of any off the top of my head.
All BT horizons are Jillick horizons?
No.
No. Doesn't that kind of play out for all?
Yeah.
Okay.
They're not that they're unrelated, but they're not the same thing.
Because it has to be a certain requirement in order
right.
to be...
Right. These diagnostic horizons and features are quantitatively defined, and their express purpose is to use for classification in soil taxonomy. The horizon designations like BK or BT, these are simply what... you use in the field to try and describe a soil profile and what's going on there.
I also have some questions about the F and G on the, given the name of the sub. I thought that was an argillic. Are we looking at the argillic horizon?
Are you talking about up here?
Yeah.
Actually, can you just maybe kind of go
okay.
over the whole thing?
So it says soil is classified as a fine, silty, mixed, mesic, superactive, typic argzerol. What's the suborder classification? Yeah, it would be a zerol. So that's going to include the order, and then the suborder there would be the next. That would be the order ending plus the next formative element, or in this case, zerol. And would you capitalize that? I know a lot of you wouldn't, but you should, because all of these taxonomic names are they're proper names, and that's just part of the convention. What's the great group classification?
Argzerol.
Remember, it's the whole thing. It's not just argy. That's the formative element, but the taxonomic name for the taxonomic great group classification is argzerol. How about the part C? What level of classification does the moisture regime appear? Okay, in this case, it's at the suborder. That's not always going to be the case. But here it is. How about at what level of classification does the temperature regime appear?
Family.
Okay, that's in the family. You see mesic up there. What does superactive refer to?
High CEC.
Yeah, it refers to the, what we call the cation exchange activity class, or CEC. How about the name of a subsurface diagnostic horizon that would be in this soil?
Is it argillic?
Argillic's certainly the most obvious one that you see there because of the, remember the great group, it's Argy-Zerol.
Is argillic capitalized?
Argillic horizon? No, that's just, no. But the taxonomic names are.
Okay. All right?
Yeah. So how about likely textural class of the argillic horizon? Textural class. Remember, there's 12 of those on a textural triangle.
Silt loam.
Silt loam could be. Technically, fine silty, it's more likely going to be, if you look at that triangle, the family, it's probably going to be in the fine silty. I think if you said coarse, I might have taken coarse loamy on this, I don't know. Coarse silty. But you probably want to have something that's got silty in the category. And the difference between the fine silty and coarse silty, anybody remember? It's 18% clay. So less than 18%, it's coarse silty. Greater than, it's fine silty. And if you get up over 35% clay, then you just get into what's known as the clayey classes. So where were we here? Would this soil be wetter or drier than a typical Argy-Udall?
Drier.
Okay, drier, because the xeric moisture regime is one that's got that characterized by the warm, dry summers. Okay, is that?
So, for subsurface diagnostic horizon, isn't argillic the only one that we could get from?
That's the only one I could pick out of there. Yeah, Emily?
And we're matching the textural class to fine silty or since they're broader categories, how do we know?
You don't really. And I guess all I would be looking for in one like this is an educated guess. Like I said, I think on this one, if somebody put silt loam, silty clay loam, those are fine.
What was skeletal again? Are we going to mean like the skeletal overrun in the name and the family name?
When you see skeletal, like loamy skeletal in the family name, what does that mean? It's got more than 35% rock fragments in it. And they could be gravel, they could be cobbles, they could be stones, they could be boulders, but just more than 35%. Yeah, Craig.
What's the timeline that we're using for the Mount Mazama deposits, is that 70,000 years ago?
Cause how many, 70?
77.
Yeah, 7,700.
Okay. Right.
And somebody else asked about this. Mount Mazama is similar to all the Cascade volcanoes in that it's erupted many times, but the big one that deposited all the ash in the Northwest was 7,700 years ago. And it's been pretty quiet since then. Anything else? Go ahead.
Was it the spodosol and the histosol look very similar on the U.S. maps, kind of different shading? Would you, which one would you be more likely to put? Because I mean.
Oh, come on now. That's.
Well, I mean, they're the same.
I don't know that I would be more or less likely to put one or the other on there, okay? Well, but, okay.
You got to get better at asking.
I don't know how to ask.
Yeah, it's a hard one. Let me see here.
They both look so similar.
Well.
In their U.S. distribution. It depends on how the printer prints it out.
Okay, and you're talking about histosols and spodosols?
Yeah.
Okay. Here's the histosols. And what's the first thing you notice in terms of the intensity of the shading? Do you see a lot of dark brown on there? No. And what that means, at least histosols, the only area that really shows up is the Everglades down in Florida, and then there's some areas in coastal Louisiana. But by and large, the histosols are, they're more limited spatially, and especially on a map like this, you're not going to see just huge areas of them. Now, at least not in the lower 48, you get up further north. If you look at the spodosols, see a difference? Yeah, you find them in some of the same areas, but you notice the difference in the color pattern? Look at Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, upstate New York. They pretty much show up as one of these darker brown patterns, meaning that's the dominant soil, and you also see it up in Wisconsin and Michigan.
Are spodosols the ones that are in northern Idaho and they just aren't mapped?
Right, they don't show up on a map like this, but I think if you took the highest elevations in the northern part of the state, you probably could shade those in. In fact, I had to get a magic marker and do that on these. That's something I've been working on for a long time, but that's why. And NRCS moves slowly. And so does the Forest Service, for that matter.
I think the Forest Service moves backwards.
Okay, other questions?
Describe the two properties that limit the use of histosols.
Two properties that limit the use of histosols? Okay, somebody help me out here. What's one?
It's wet.
Okay, they're wet. So what do you do about them?
Drainage.
Drain them. And what's another one?
They decompose plant and animal material very slowly, so it could be good to know.
They have low bulk density.
Yeah, they have this real low bulk density and what an engineer might call low bearing capacity. So if you want to put something on them, like a road or a building, they're not going to make a very good foundation. And what you typically do is have to sink pilings down till you hit something more solid that you can anchor a structure into.
Or once you drain them, then they start decomposing a lot faster.
Right, once they're drained, which, you know, you figure for most any land use, you've got to get rid of excess water. And once you do that to histosols, then you've got the added issue of that subsidence. Anything else?
So which ones are more common out of the four we talked about in the U.S.?
Okay, well, if you think about, well, it depends on if you're thinking of the lower 48 or if you throw Alaska into the mix. And the thing about the histosols, well, we looked at the map and, you know, they're not especially abundant here. The we said for the U.S. it's only 1-2%, something like that. And you look at gelisols, though. Now, lower 48, not much going on, but if you look at Alaska, and on a global basis, about 9%, and pretty close to that in the U.S., but almost all of those are going to be up in Alaska. And you can see this map here with all the shading. And spodosols here, 3.5%, something like that. Other questions?
Is the exam cover andosols?
Yeah, the exam will start with the diagnostic horizons and features, and then go up through Tuesday, which was andosols. So that's four soil orders that you'll be responsible for.
What's the difference between mesic and typic?
Difference between mesic and typic? Mesic is a soil temperature regime. Okay, and that's the one where you have a mean annual soil temperature between 8 and 15 degrees C, or what, 47 to 59 Fahrenheit.
Okay.
But when you had a sporter, then according to like Estep and Mudic, I guess that would be less of the subgroup classification.
Typic is you'll always see that as a subgroup level of classification, like a typic Argyzerol or a typic haplocryod, those types of things. That doesn't really have anything to do with moisture or temperature regimes. It's just meaning that whatever the grade group is, let's say it's an Argyzerol. If you have a typic Argyzerol, it simply means that it's kind of the central concept of that grade group. Nothing out of the ordinary. As opposed to an aquic Argyzerol, which would be one that's tending to be wetter than the typical variety. Hannah.
I was noticing while I was doing my homework assignment that in some of the taxonomic, I couldn't find the soil moisture regime. It wasn't like they didn't have like either a very definite like a Zerol or a Udol or a Eustic.
Right.
And I was curious why that was like in some and not.
Well, it depends. If you're talking about gelisols, do you need to have anything about a temperature regime in there?
No, because you only have.
Right, because they're defined by a thermal regime. In other words, having this permafrost in them. The histosols, you don't see anything about moisture regime there because the vast majority of them are wet. They have an aquic moisture regime. There is the one exception, the pholus, but you know it's a separate suborder. So it just differs. And get into spodosols, the vast majority come from, they're almost, all of them are from humid environments. And or where you get fair amount of precip, so you could probably assume that they all have eutic or perutic or even aquic moisture regimes. So the thing is you don't find them in dry areas. Now when you get into the rest, like andisols, and you saw with these that it's all about moisture and temperature regimes with them because you find them in such a wide range of environmental conditions. Anybody else?
Yeah. One quick question. When you talk about the subgroup, do you include just that qualifying word, or do you do typic plus the grade group name?
Okay, the subgroup classification would not just be typic.
Okay.
It would be typic Argyzerol or typic Candy Udol. It's the entire thing. Yeah.
Can you cover the difference between typic and haplo?
I guess conceptually there isn't a whole lot of difference. It's just the level where you find it. Typic always comes out at the subgroup level, and that formative element haplo or hapla, that's always at the grade group level. And the term hapla means simple or minimal. And where you see it, like in a haplozerol, for example, that means it's a zerol that doesn't have an argillic horizon, it doesn't have a natric horizon, doesn't have a calcic horizon, or some of these other types of features. It, more times than not, it indicates the lack of features. So it's just kind of the simple variety. And then, as I said, typic is always going to be at the subgroup level. Yeah.
What I meant to say is Estep drier than typic?
It depends on. Okay. Typic what? It depends on what the rest of the subgroup classification is. Because probably at the suborder level, you might have a moisture regime there. And if it's a typic Argyoqual, then that means it's got an aquic moisture regime. And an Ustic Argyoqual would therefore be drier because it means it's still an aquic moisture regime, but it's tending towards being Ustic. Okay. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Okay. Anything else? Going once. Twice. Okay. So, I guess back to our, look at our simplified key here. So we've talked about the first four soil orders, permafrost, organic, the albic photic horizons, and then volcanic ash soils. We get down to the fifth order to key out, and these are the oxisols. And the simple description is the intensely weathered soils of tropical and subtropical environments. Let me see, I think I put the, find this real quickly. I've got the keys to taxonomy here. I just want to show you this quickly. This is actually a pretty short definition. So it says other soils that have either one, an oxic horizon, and then they talk about the boundary and blah, blah, blah. So that's one characteristic or defining characteristic is an oxic horizon. Or the second one is you've got 40% or more clay throughout the entire soil, and then it's got a candic horizon that has the weatherable mineral properties of an oxic horizon. So essentially, I would think of this as soils that have an oxic horizon, okay? And that's one of the diagnostic horizons that we mentioned. I'll talk a little bit more about it. If you're curious, these are the criteria for an oxic horizon. I don't want to go through the whole thing, but you know, you've got a thickness requirement, and then this is kind of the key thing, less than 10% weatherable minerals. And that gets back to this idea that the minerals like feldspars and the pyroxenes and amphiboles that tend to weather more rapidly in soils have long since weathered out in these things. And you'll find very few weatherable minerals, if any, in them. The other thing, you go down through here, pretty low CEC, and that kind of is this idea of low activity clays like kaolinite specifically, and there are a few others, but kaolinite would be the most common one. It has a fairly low cation exchange capacity relative to 2-to-1 layer silicates. So it's this idea of pretty intensely weathered materials, and that's what I would keep in mind in terms of these things. The term oxisol, the root comes from French oxide, which is pretty self-explanatory, but very highly weathered soils found primarily in the intertropical regions, few weatherable minerals, and often rich in iron and aluminum oxides. And this concept of a rust pile, that's kind of the idea there, that iron oxides, aluminum oxides, in a well-drained soil, they're very stable materials, and so they tend to accumulate over time. If you look at the global ice-free land area, it was 7.5%, and here's the map. You can see where the oxisols are. Here's the tropics in through here. You can see South America, Africa, and parts of Southeast Asia, and that's primarily where you find oxisols. In the U.S., look at our map. Notice the lower 48 there. Do you see any shading on that? No, and if it wasn't for Hawaii, we would not have oxisols in the United States. And here on the map where you see Hawaii, especially the older islands, if you're familiar with Hawaii, it's this chain of volcanic islands, and as you get to the northwest, these are the oldest, and then the big island is where you've got the actively erupting volcanoes down there. So the oxisols are on the older islands, and that, you know, as a result, we don't really have a very high percentage in the United States. I have heard that if you look at the very southern tip of Florida down here, that there are probably soils down there that might qualify as oxisols, but they're not widely distributed, but at least pretty close to it. And those are the kinds of soils that NRCS likes to ignore because it kind of messes up the system a little bit. It's easier to say there are no oxisols in the lower 48. So in terms of the percentage, you know, gosh, 0.02% of the land area in the United States. It says the oxisols characterized by relatively low or extremely low native fertility in most cases. They have low nutrient reserves because you think about the best sources of things like calcium and magnesium and potassium are these primary minerals as they weather, right? Whether it's hydrolysis or whatever type of weathering reaction, this is how calcium gets released, potassium, magnesium. And once you run out of weatherable minerals, you don't have any source of replenishment. So you kind of end up with, at least in terms of nutrients, some of these soils go bankrupt. There's just nothing, there's nothing in reserve. Low CEC, and this other note, high phosphorus retention by the oxide minerals. And we talked a little bit about that with andisols. You see the same thing in many oxisols as well. And so phosphorus nutrition can often be a problem. This other note, it says most of the nutrients in oxisol ecosystems are contained in the standing vegetation and the decomposing plant material. So it's a really tight nutrient cycle. You get into the subsoil and there's generally very little, if any, in terms of plant nutrients. And I'll show you a couple of examples of this. The last note, it says despite low fertility though, oxisols can be quite productive if you have inputs of lime and fertilizers. And there's a lot of examples of that worldwide. The problem is, if you look at where oxisols tend to be in Africa, the access to lime and fertilizers there is very limited. And even in parts of South America, you just don't have these things that are easily accessible to most people. So if you look at the classification of oxisols, there are five suborders. And you can see them listed here with a short definition. The first order to key out, or suborder to key out, are the aquox, and those are the ones with the high water table. So you start to see this kind of trend where the wet soils tend to key out quickly. Notice the second suborder, torox. Remember the formative element tor or tori? It means an aridic moisture regime. So you actually have oxisols with an aridic moisture regime. And this gets back to this idea of people's concept of what the tropics is. And the tropics, you know, you think about a rainforest in many cases, but remember, the definition of the tropics is that there is very little seasonal change in temperature. And you've got everything from extremely dry environments to extremely moist environments. So the concept of tropics is not about moisture. It's about very little fluctuation in temperature. Okay, the third suborder, ustox, those would be the ustic moisture regimes, or what we think of as semi-arid and subhumid climates. Perox, this is the, remember we talked a little bit about a periodic moisture regime, where every month out of the year, the precipitation exceeds the potential evapotranspiration. So that would be these soils. And here you might be thinking about something like a tropical rainforest environment where you would have perox. And then finally, the default category would be the eudox, and those are the oxisols that have a eudic moisture regime. Now you notice these are all moisture regimes here, right? Aquic, aridic, ustic, periodic, and eudic. Xeric is missing from that. Anybody want to hazard a guess why? Yeah, you remember this idea of a xeric moisture regime is one of temperate regions where you have an actual winter and summer, and in fact it would be cool, moist winters and warm, dry summers. So you've got this seasonal fluctuation. Whereas the whole idea of the oxisol and where you find them in the tropics is that you don't get this sort of seasonal variation. So because of the temperature remaining more or less constant or not fluctuating that much. And in fact, most of the oxisols that you find in the world are going to be in isohyperthermic or maybe isothermic type of temperature regimes. And the other problem with having a Xerox is copyright issues. You've all heard of Xerox, and you'd hate to have to battle them in court for a taxonomic name. So it's better it worked out the way that it did.
So where are we going to find a Torox?
There's some in Hawaii.
Yeah.
You know, if you've been to Hawaii, you know that the islands there, they tend to be very moist on the
west side.
Yeah, or the north side. The southwest sides tend to be the real dry ones, and there are Torox there. In fact, you're going to see an example of one here. So the if you look at the way the suborders are arrayed, it's really a climatic thing where you've got the wet ones or the poorly drained ones, the aquox, and then down here it just goes from dry to wet with Torox, Ustox, Eudox, and then the Perox being on the wetter end of that. And of course these guys, it's more about being poorly drained than how much rainfall or the distribution. All right, a few examples. First one from Hawaii. This is the island of Oahu, and this is one of the oldest of the Hawaiian islands. And there are a lot of oxisols in the central part of the island. Here's an example. Anybody want to hazard a guess what that crop is?
Sugarcane.
Yeah, sugarcane. They don't grow so much of it there anymore, but you used to see a lot of sugarcane, pineapples, and those types of things growing in these soils, and it really created some challenges. But this is the soil profile that goes with it. You've seen this picture a bunch of times, and this is the soil known as the Molokai series. And you can see the classification, very fine, so it's got a relatively fine particle size family, a lot of clay, kaolinitic, there's the dominant clay type, isohyperthermic, so it's the hyperthermic temperature regime, and remember the iso means very less than 6 degree variation. And then here's the typic eutrotorox. All right, so oxisol, aridic or toric moisture regime. And remember eutro or the EU, we saw it in some other soils.
High pH
or higher base saturation. And this happens to be a variety of oxisols that probably has a little bit better native fertility than most of them. And so it is recognized here at the great group level.
So what does it indicate again, the higher fertility?
Higher base saturation. So it has more calcium and magnesium and probably potassium than your typical oxisols.
So is it like eutrophied?
No, it's the same root.
Yeah.
But in this case, it probably has more to do with the parent material being, in this case, mentions basic igneous rocks, so maybe a little bit higher fertility than some of the other types of parent materials. And the last note down here, it says slightly acid to neutral, so the pH here maybe about 6.5, so not nearly as acidic as you might expect. But you notice the BO horizons or the oxic diagnostic horizons in this case, and not really a whole lot in terms of horizonation, and fairly, well, pretty highly weathered soil in this case. Here's another landscape with the, this is in Puerto Rico, and this is a really old landscape, and the description talks about the steppe landscape with these older surfaces. And in this case, the oxisols are going to be associated with the higher, older landscapes. Maybe some of these things have been around, you know, for hundreds of thousands of years, if not more. And the soil profile is this guy right here. An inceptic haplodox. So eutic moisture regime, hapla, more or less the minimum horizonation here. Swims plowed, a BO horizon, so here's the oxic horizon. And you'll notice here's 3 feet, 4 feet at the bottom of the soil profile. You're actually getting into a sea horizon. So it's not a particularly deep soil, and as oxisols go, you normally expect to see them weathered much more deeply than this. And that's why at the subgroup level, you've got this term in septic, meaning it's tending towards being what soil order? Inceptisol, yeah, or it's got some characteristics of an inceptisol, which we haven't talked about inceptisols yet, but they're generally not well-developed soils. They sort of have a minimum amount of development. The landscape that you see here, this is in Africa, and I don't know how well you can see it, but this is some burned forest, and if you look carefully, you can see something coming up in there, and that happens to be corn. And this is an example of slash and burn agriculture, which is something that has been widely practiced on oxisols. Because you mentioned that the nutrients are contained in the standing biomass and the decomposing plant material. So the typical strategy would be to come in and burn an area, and then you get this ash that's produced from the burning, and it's fairly nutrient rich. You plant a crop, and you might be able to do this two or three times and get a fairly good stand of whatever you're growing, and then it's you more or less exhausted that nutrient release, and then you move on and burn another area. And obviously that's not something that you can do if you've got a lot of people and political boundaries and so on. So there's been a lot of research focused in Africa looking at these oxisols and alternatives to slash and burn agriculture. Obviously, if you had lime and fertilizer, it'd be a pretty easy solution, but in many areas like this, you don't. So you have to look at different types of cropping systems and alternative ways to try and improve the nutrient status of them. And it's a real challenge. What's that?
They have small headers on their combines.
Very small, yeah. The last example here is this is a soil from Rwanda, and the reason I put it in here is because it's a little bit different than what most people think of. Normally, if you read about oxisols, you say, well, they don't have much organic matter in them, and it's not always true. This doesn't show up real well in this picture, but this you're looking at about a 2 meter depth down here at the bottom of the profile. And you see how dark the surface is? And this is a little bit higher elevation soil. Elevation's above 1,000 meters or so, so over 3,000 feet. And it's a little bit cooler, and because of that, it's not uncommon to see some fairly large quantities of organic matter. And this, if you look at the classification up here, this actually has two terms that are at the subgroup level. It's a humic, rhotic, eutrostox. And the term humic obviously refers to humus or soil organic matter, and being, in this case, the soil is enriched in those. The rhotic refers to a dark reddish color, and then I think you should recognize the rest of this. Ustox, ustic moisture regime, and a eutrostox, meaning once again a little bit higher base saturation in there. So these are actually, as oxisols go, probably some of the prime soils for ag production. And this guy right here, you can see bananas growing there, and they've got there's some corn here in the foreground, and I think peanuts here in the right above the exposure there. So, you know, probably one of the more fertile or more agriculturally suited oxisols that you'll find.
How sustainable is that if they farm it? Is it going to get rid of the organic matter?
Well, I don't know what the answer to that is. It probably the organic matter levels are maintained in part because of the climate. And I think if you maintain the vegetative cover and incorporate that back in, you probably can, I think it should be somewhat sustainable.
Okay.
And it looks like they've got a real mix of things here, like, you know, a legume ground cover that probably gets turned into the soil, and then the bananas and corn. So pretty good mix, and that's usually a good formula for success. The last thing about oxisols, maybe not good fertility, but great physical properties. And that's because iron oxides are really good at aggregating or creating very stable, strong soil structure. And if you look at a lot of oxisols, you're not going to see so much blocky structure down in the subsoil, but it is often described as granular. And this picture right here is a thin section, a real thin slice of an oxisol that you're looking through a microscope at. And you see this reddish, yellowish material. The dark areas here are pores, but these are granules. They look like granular structure, and in fact they are. And it's really a mix of kaolinite and iron oxides. And these iron oxides are what make these very stable aggregates. So great physical properties. If you go someplace where you've got an oxisol, it can rain like crazy in the afternoon for half an hour, and 5 minutes later you don't see standing water because of the very good permeability and infiltration associated with this. These lighter colored grains, probably quartz, because that's not considered a weatherable mineral, at least from the perspective of soil taxonomy. So good physical properties here. Now I had some supplemental stuff for you. I'd like to just run through these real quickly. This first one, this table, we've looked at before, and I just bring it back here to emphasize an important concept with regard to oxisols, and that is this process of desilication and the formation of an oxic horizon. Because, you know, we talked about iron, and if you look in the Earth's crust, it's somewhere around 5, 6, 7% on a weight basis. But you look at an oxisol like this guy right here, and it may be 20%. So you're getting this enrichment in both iron and aluminum over time as a result of intense weathering. And the idea is that all these other things weather out, and you're pretty much left with iron and aluminum, or what we call the residual accumulation. Everything else goes away, and all of a sudden you've got a much higher concentration of iron and aluminum oxides. And the process desilication, where you lose silica over time, we talked about that. So just intense weathering, desilication, and this residual accumulation of iron and aluminum oxides. This is a photo of an oxisol from Brazil. And kind of interesting here, you notice all this white stuff. This is one of the areas, one of the research stations in Brazil, where they're looking at how to increase ag production on these soils. This one, depending on when you downloaded the handout, it may not be on there. It is now, but sorry about that. But what they did is they came in and they painted the roots. And that's what, they painted them white so you could see how well the roots are doing in this soil. And a few notes here. It says this soil is formed in ancient oxidized sediments, and they're made up of quartz sand, kaolinite, and iron and aluminum oxides, with almost all the weatherable minerals dissolved prior to deposition. So this is not necessarily an old soil on an old landscape. It's, I think of it as pre-weathered materials that get deposited. And it's simply, the materials are quartz, kaolinite, and iron aluminum oxide, so it does meet the requirements of an oxic horizon. 60 to 70% clay, granular structure throughout, and bulk densities of 1.1 to 1.2 grams per cubic centimeter. That kind of gets back to this idea of good physical properties. Well, what they were doing here is using lime and fertilizer. And this particular soil, when the picture was taken, they'd been doing it for 20 years, and they were getting really good crops. This is 2 meters down at the bottom here, and you can see you've got roots going all the way down there. The good production on it. The note here is that without the lime and fertilizers, it says it's a naturally acid and infertile soil. In its natural state, it's supported what they call savanna or cerrado vegetation that is so deficient and calcium and phosphorus that it doesn't nourish cattle when grazed. And this is one of the theories is why you don't find large animals in South America. Now, if you want to see big animals, you go to parts of Africa, right? Elephants. And South America, not so much. And one of the possible reasons for that is these oxisols that really are deficient in calcium and phosphorus, which is something a large animal is going to need quite a bit of. So lime and fertilizer, you can make these very productive. Just the trick is getting the lime and the fertilizer. We talked about plinthite and BV horizon, and we mentioned that it's found in more highly weathered soils. You find it in the southeastern United States. You find it in a lot of oxisols. And this is the stuff when you take it out and expose it to repeated wetting and drying cycles, it hardens into ironstone, or what people call laterite. And this stuff has actually been used. This is in Malaysia. And these are plinthite blocks that they've built this church out of. And I think this particular one is about 500 years old. So it's makes for pretty good building material in areas where you don't have rock resources. How many people have heard of terra preta? Okay. Well, this is one of the big mysteries that anthropologists and soil scientists have been wrestling with over the last 50 years or so. And terra preta is the name given to these soils that they find in areas that were supported earlier human occupation. And then most of the ones that I'm familiar with are in Brazil, and hence the terra preta, it's Portuguese, it means black earth. And these are really dark soils. Here's a cut in one, and you see all this black in here. Well, these are artificially made, and nobody knows exactly how they did it, but they somehow use charcoal and some way of making charcoal, adding it to the soil with other types of organic residues to improve the fertility of these things. And here's a couple of photos that, I don't know, this is off the web, but here's terra preta, and this is the quote soil that has not been altered with the charcoal. So I take what you want from this, but there definitely seems to be a very big difference and a fairly long-lasting effect of what they were doing to these terra preta soils. And there's another picture of it. And so here's the regular oxisol. There's the crop you get. Here's the terra preta. There's the crop you get. Proof positive, right? Just remember, it's on the internet, so you can believe it. And if you go to Brazil, you can actually find they sell this stuff. And you'll convenience stores, you know, you pick up beer, chips, all that stuff, and a little bit of terra preta. You can haul it off. And these guys are out digging it up, putting it in some sort of a trailer or something to haul it off where it is sold. So it's really billed as good stuff. And finally, if you look on the internet, you can actually find a recipe for making terra preta, even though nobody really knows exactly how it's done. Here's one suggestion: that you take charcoal, charged in manure tea, vermiculite, cow manure, peat moss, and terracotta shards, so break up some clay flower pots, mix it all together, stick it in the soil, and you might have something that approximates these terra preta soils. But just a way of trying to improve native fertility and productivity of these things. Okay, I'm going to stop there, and we will